Hey, I'm Andy White, and welcome to Masters of Medic. This is the show where we talk to the best of the best in enterprise sales. In this episode, we're talking to Thibaut Sirol, one of the greatest regional leaders in our industry. Thibaut founded the EMEA region for the mega success story Snowflake and shares a ton of wisdom from building out from the first employees well into the hundreds from start to IPO and beyond. I cannot wait for you to hear this episode. Hey, Thibaut, welcome to Masters of Medic. It is awesome to have you on the show, and I'm thrilled to have you here because not only do you meet the criteria we have of being an expert in revenue with tons of useful experience, but you're also a guest from Europe, from where we are in the world. So, you know, so many of the guests in the past have come from, you know, over that great pond between us and the United States of America. But you're here and you're located in London. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Brilliant.
Good. So welcome to the show.
Very happy to join this podcast today.
Thank you very much. Well, for those that don't know you, maybe you could give an introduction to yourself. I know that you've been working in software for 20 years. You don't look old enough to have that amount of experience, but perhaps you could give us a little bit of intro into your background and how you got into this wonderful world of technology sales.
Yeah, so I am old enough. Maybe the zoom or the light, I don't know. Nobody will notice that with my British accent, but I'm French. Sorry for that. I live in the UK for 6 years, and I'm working in the IT and software space for more than 20 years now. And I started Snowflake in EMEA 4 years ago. So I was the first employee on the ground. And before that, I was working for different companies. So Bazaar Voice, where I spent 4 years. This is where I joined when I moved out from France to the UK to be in charge of Europe. For Bazaar Voice. And before that, I spent almost 7-8 years in BMC Software, where my last position was a country manager for France. So yeah, heavily involved in this space, always on sales. This is probably the only thing I'm able to do in life. But working in this space for 20 years and started this activity for Snowflake 4 years ago.
4 years ago. And it's funny you say that. You mentioned, you know, having the expertise in sales and that experience. And you said that, you know, the only thing you do in life. But one of the things that's fascinating to me and so much of the success story is Snowflake and their, you know, what you started for them in EMEA and built in EMEA. And that is much more than sales. You have to say, you know, with building a team like that. And I think this is just a fascinating topic for me of how you would describe this kind of that role of being the first on the ground in a region like EMEA. I'd love to hear about that.
So it was very, very important for me to, so I always pay attention to the choices I did in my career. So before going to software, I was working just after school. So I never had anything in my life. I need to pay for everything. So my business school, I need to work at this period of time for HP in parallel to pay my business school because my parents didn't have any money to give me for this, but I wanted to go to a very good business school and I did that. And after this, I was realizing, okay, I need to go. I started really in 2000 where the world was collapsing with the internet. And I was looking at different things and I said, okay, maybe I need to start probably on services first. This will help me to have a real sense of what the market is. And I learned a lot. It was extremely difficult. It's not like today when you go and try to find a job. But I did that for 7 years. I overachieved in many ways. And I was able to sell a project end-to-end to BMC Software. And the country manager said, okay, maybe we need to hire this guy. So I did that. And initially, I didn't came from the software background. So they told me, okay, so you need to go on a specialist role to prove yourself, what I did. And I did more than 200% the first year. And in that case, I moved to an account management role and I became the global account manager worldwide for Orange for this company. And I did this choice of BMC Software. It was a large company. Honestly, I was a little bit disappointed. until BMC Software bought Blade Logic. And Blade Logic saw the arrival of John McMahon and Cédric Pech and Luca Lazzaron and Jeremy Degan. And all those guys arrive, and we see it changed my life, it changed my career, and we can probably come back to this. So this was a large company. After that, I wanted to go to change the space, and the digital marketing space was extremely buzzy right now. And I wanted to go out of IT because I spent already 14 years working on IT, and said, let's go on digital marketing. And I met this company and Bazaar Voice. And I worked also with Cédric at this period of time together. So Cédric was in charge of Europe. When Cédric left, I took over the role for Europe. And this is where I moved to the UK. I always had in mind, since the business school, I always had in mind, okay, if you want to have a proper career and win significant things in your life, you have two options. Either you go on finance or you sell software. So I had this in mind, at least to achieve my goals. And I had this plan in head. But Bazaar Voice was an established company, and I need to also, redo a lot of things, but it was not a blank page. And when I was talking to John, I remember because John introduced me to McMahon, introduced me, and thanks for him because he changed my life, to Snowflake and to Chris Degnan, who is the actual CEO and one of the best guys I was able to work with the different one I already mentioned. But what was missing in my CV was really to start something from scratch, from zero. And I was young enough in my head, at least, to say, okay, I will start, and I'm okay to do that. And also, you have a lot of you need to. I was managing around 200 people in Europe in Bazaar Voice. Everybody was saying, "You are completely crazy. You are going to this company," and I said, "Yeah, but I think the outcome will be extremely big." And nothing. So nobody knew Snowflake at this period of time, but doing the proper assessment, having the conversation with John, who was at the board, and my immediate meetings were extremely good, and I felt the potential of starting from scratch. And this was something that was missing for me, and I wanted to achieve this. Like, okay. Can I do something from zero where I can build the culture I want, where I can hire the people I want, and really grow this business? But the fundamental thing also is the solution and the technology was extremely good and part of my decision criteria. But we can come back to this. Sorry, it's a long answer, but just to explain how I get there.
Yeah, no, I love that. Thank you for that, because that, I mean, my mind's racing right now with so many interesting things we can dig into there. One of the things I was actually planning on asking you, which you touched on a little bit, was about your sort of evolution from different roles and whether there was, which it sounds like there will be, so we can dig into it, but whether there was a kind of point in your career, like a pivotal moment where someone or something changed the way you think about sales. I can certainly remember, for me, my person, it's another John, but it's John Kaplan for me, and working with Force Management, where I had that kind of like, I call it like a eureka moment, where I went from thinking that I was, you know, I was a hardworking, conscientious, you know, tuned in into all that I thought were the latest trends and books salesperson, but I was almost sort of hitting this glass ceiling of ability because I just didn't know about all of the sort of elite things that top salespeople do. It was almost like it opened up a whole new world to me. And I was curious, because you know, you had 6 years at Dev Team and then to BMC. And I wonder whether it was that switch that happened. But it sounds like, from what you said there, it sounds like it was when the Blade Logic team came in and John McMahon and his team came in to BMC. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So it's exactly that. To be honest, you know, when you join a company, you are coming from an outside space. As I said, when I was working like crazy in business school, I had this idea in mind of software company and the dream world. And when I joined BMC, I was at the beginning super interested, but after this, a little bit disappointed on the way the things and the sales execution were made. And I will always remember we were in like Nashville, Tennessee for kickoff just after the acquisition of BlakeLogic. And honestly, I was before the acquisition, I was about to leave because I was disappointed of things that I was learning in BMC at this period of time. And so Nashville, Tennessee, it's not Las Vegas, it's not New York, or it's not San Francisco, but BMC did that. And it shows a lot. There was a CRO at this period of time, and the guy came on stage, and at this period, it was like BMC rocks. So it was everything around rock and roll. And after the session, I remember that John came on stage, and he did one of the best speech I heard. And I think the previous CRO took an analogy of saying, yeah, you need to be like Tomb Raider on the field. And John arrived and said, no, you need to be like Braveheart. And he shows this picture. So the way he was doing that, and he did a full analysis on BlakeLogic and how they did the approach, and it was mind-blowing for me. And after that, I remember it was a pause and like a coffee break, and Cédric Pech came to me, and also Alim Belkatir, who is one of the fantastic guys I was working with. And they came to me because I was in charge of France Telecom and Orange, one of the largest potential customer for BlakeLogic. And because they were quite disappointed of the quality of salespeople, they arrived with very, like, okay, who is this guy? And I will ask the right question. And I think, I had Cédric on the phone yesterday, by the way, it was quite fun. And I think Cédric at this period of time asked a lot of questions, and he was looking at me. And at the end, the question he was asking was everything around Medic regarding an opportunity I was pursuing. And I was able to answer. But at this period of time, I didn't have the substance of the things that I was applying myself.
Yes.
Medic by itself, and it's said in your book, it's like a compass, and where you will answer questions that will help you to make sure that you master entirely your sales process and your sales motion. Mm-hmm. But it's not like something magical. It's just a structure that helps you. If you do that, you have a very good success rate. And so immediately, Cédric, I think, felt that, okay, maybe this guy has something, he's able to learn. And I have been invited to one of the last bootcamp of BlakeLogic. So with all the BlakeLogic guys, I think I was one of the only guy at BMC.
Oh, cool.
And to do some trainings, and I met Paul Kent and Andy Sadler and Mauro Trione and Paul McGrath and Kelly Connery, all those guys that are now my friends. And I realized, okay, I'm more close to those guys in the way they are selling than the BMC old-fashioned people. So it literally changed my life because it helped me to put words on what I think was right, but in a more structured way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And one of the things that has been a consistent bit of feedback about people that have come to me and said that they found Medic, whether it be by content or a book or anything like that, the consistent bit of feedback I get from salespeople who are new to it, they say, this is how I've always sold. This is how I sell. I just didn't know there was a name for it. I didn't know there was a framework. And I think that is probably one of the main reasons why Medic has gone to be so successful and proliferate so much, is because it's just natural. It's the way customers buy. And if you overlay a framework to that, it is basically just applying common sense into the framework. And so it's funny to hear your sort of story was almost similar, that you were kind of doing these things naturally because you could answer all of the questions from Cédric. But you probably didn't know you were doing it. And then all of a sudden...
Yeah, but also, yeah. I think I didn't have... I was doing a part. I think I learned a lot at this period of time. And what is very important, so in the number of people that I meet are saying, yeah, of course I work with Medic. And when you dig into that, the most important piece is to experience it properly.
Yes.
And it's tough. It's not easy. So I remember the first real time was something at Orange, where I think I did like 64 interviews during during a business value assessment that we were building for the company. Mm-hmm. And Cedric came with me, and Alim Belkati also. We did that together, and it was tough. Mm-hmm. But I experienced it, and I experienced the power of it, having access, asking the right questions to the incoming buyer, building multiple champions, influencing the decision criteria, and having all the right metrics to do my business case. And it was honestly very difficult, but I was able to be coached by somebody who had a very strong experience on this, and I was like a sponge. So the problem you have sometimes is people are saying, "Yeah, I know Medic. Yeah, it's part of this," but it's checkbox for them, and it's not something that is embedded. And this is very important. This needs to be part of your DNA.
Yeah, I agree. I could not agree more. I kind of put it down to almost sort of four stages, and it's not a linear process either, in as much as the first stage is learning Medic. And a lot of people will do that just by, you know, their definition of learning Medic will be knowing what the definitions are of each of the letters, right? And that's obviously, as you mentioned there, is not enough. The next sort of stage that is to try and put it into practice. You've learned what they are, and then you're trying to put them into practice, which is, you know, quite close to the learning stage. Those two almost go hand in hand. And then I also see there's almost this bigger gap then where the individual or the team would look to embrace Medic. And that's where they kind of, they get it in, they feel it, like the same way as, you know, we both have when we sort of had that kind of eureka moment, it clicked. Okay, this is something I can see. You either see a sort of a success, you might have had a meeting and you see it sort of progress more because you focused on Medic, or just some sort of good feedback you get from it. And then that's when you embrace it. But then there's this fourth stage, which is the one that I think is often overlooked. And it's kind of the height, the peak of it, which is where it becomes like a second nature, where you're actually not thinking proactively about Medic because it is just how you operate. It's like your the way your mind works is in those things. And I think so many, if that's a scale, so many people are over here saying that they practice Medic, they know Medic, and they've got a long way to go. But the beauty of it is, and this is, I think, we talk about the strengths Medic, another one of the big strengths is that unlike so many sales initiatives, programs, tech, all that stuff that is very top-down benefits, it suits sales leaders. And then, you know, as it comes down the ladder, it sort of weakens in its value. For me, Medic's the other way around. The main value, the most value, is for the individual contributor. And then it kind of goes up from there. So what I love is the idea of if you are here, if you're listening to this and say, yeah, well, maybe that resonates and I have got a long way to go to be second nature, you're the first person that's going to benefit from this, you know, and everyone else around you will as well, but you'll be the first person to benefit. And that's for me, is quite cool.
Yeah, no, it's very, very, it's a very important point. By the way, I was not necessarily having words for that, but on having the individual to really think that it's for them and it's not for like management, it's not for reporting. And when you realize that it's for you and you act like an entrepreneur on your sales campaigns, and this will just only mandatory to make something good on your sales campaign. So it's yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that idea of like the entrepreneur mindset of having your own, you know, seeing your territory, your patch, your number as being your business. I used to, you know, like a bit like a franchise sort of thing. It's like you know, your team at Snowflake had a Snowflake franchise. The only difference is, and I love this analogy, the difference is, you know, if you have a franchise, you don't get paid holiday. You know, you don't get an SDR sat, you know, helping make your calendar really busy. You don't have, you know, you don't have some the franchise owner or the company behind the franchise pay for you to have a sales engineer at hand. You know, so it's like having a franchise, but even better. And I'm looking at the success you folks had at Snowflake. I'm pretty sure they got compensated better than most franchises out there as well. So yeah, I love that analogy. That's a really good one.
But it's difficult, you know. When I was even when I was talking about the choices, when people were saying around me, like my parents, my friends, were saying, why are you doing that? You have a very good job. Why you will do that alone? And honestly, the first year, it's tough. I think I counted because I will ask for the British citizenship, so I need to count my travel. And I think the first year I spent half of the year out of my home.
Wow.
So yeah. you need to be ready for that. But yes, it pay off. It doesn't pay off always. So I was lucky also to find the right team and the right company. But and I'm super humble regarding that. But if you apply the right things, there is no way you can be successful in life if you don't take risk.
Yes.
And I think honestly, I had this conversation with John and with Cedric and with Chris Dignan of saying, okay, something is missing is building from scratch, and because you are responsible of what you did, and because when you have an heritage of a team, as you said, you have pre-sales and you have a huge team of marketing and you have a PR and you have a lot of things. When I started, I literally go to IKEA to buy the furniture for the and I was building that. I saw a very nice post recently of a startup and the guy was showing the first chair he bought, but I was doing that.
Yeah.
I was buying the plants, et cetera. So, but it's also the nice piece. And this is what I love. So
yeah. I love that. And so let's talk a bit about building that team then, because, you know, genuine first guy on the ground, you know, your person number one. So who's, you know, you've got the best experience of this. So who's person number two? Who was person number two in terms of the role? And did you get that right? And, you know, who are the early team that's really important if you're setting up a region as you were?
Yeah. So it took me around 6 months. So I think it was in June 2016 where I had the first call from John. Mm-hmm. I had a first call with Chris around like August. It took us 4 months of discussions. Mm-hmm. with Chris Dignan. The first meeting I had with him was absolutely when I have like simple meetings with people, when you speak the same language, it's exactly mm-hmm. like medic. When people understand that, it clicks immediately. And
yes.
It was the case with Chris Dignan. So Christmas time, I decide to jump and I resigned from Bazaar Boys. And I was already in the mindset of, okay, I will build. It's like building my own company. So where should I start? And initially, and what was very good with Chris is he said, yeah, you will be the boss for Europe, so you need to make your own choices. So even he was doing, but the trust is extremely important for that mm-hmm. when you start a business like that. And we had an immediate trust with Chris when we started. And so the first guys I needed to get were sales guys, but and pre-sales. So mm-hmm. pre-sales, I was not an expert on the data warehouse, so I need the help from Snowflake, and they hire someone from mm-hmm. the market. Mm-hmm. But very quickly, what I said to Chris is we don't need necessarily people from the market. Mm-hmm. What we need at the beginning is champion builders, so very strong guys with medic environment mm-hmm. who will be able to be risk takers themselves. And we will be able to find some customers that will follow them just because they are them. Because mm-hmm. what you need to realize, Andy, is when I started, and it's a true story, people were literally thinking I was selling ice cream. Because when you go in London and you go in Regent Street or Oxford Street, you have the Snowflake shop, and they are selling ice cream. And this was really the beginning, because the name was not resonating with the rest. So some techies we knew that, but not necessary. So you need to find risk takers. So the first guy I hired was somebody where, and it was a meeting that I had, like a breakfast with him out of the blue. Honestly, we had a discussions. He had already a job. We had immediately a click, and we were thinking, okay, we need to do that together. And he started as a sales, but he will be the leader for UK, because mm-hmm. I started the UK first, and I said, okay, at the beginning, you need to have when you start a company like that, mm-hmm. you need to have people that will sell themselves. So if you have managers who are behind their screens and managing Excel sheet, For when you do a startup, it doesn't work. So I need to have this. So this is where I hired Julien Alterac. And after this, so he's in charge of UK. And we did, honestly, this success story would not have been possible without him. And also, we started with one other sales guy, outstanding sales guy, that was working with me. Mm-hmm. So Julien, we worked in similar companies, but we never worked with mm-hmm. him. So I did not know him well at all mm-hmm. before that. But I was working in Bazaar Voice with somebody that left Bazaar Voice. And he left Bazaar Voice because he felt the potential was not there. And he left to a different company. So he was only 2 months in the company. I had breakfast with him and I said, and it was Marcus Schmaus. And I said to him, Marcus, I will start this. This is probably the opportunity of your life. And I explained, and he said, and I remember because he's German originally, and he was shaking his hand like this, and he said, but very quickly he said, okay, let's go. And at the beginning, it was very important for me to have people that will trust me.
Yes.
They know how I operate and people that I can trust. So the trust is extremely important. So two sales, one pre-sales that I didn't choose, but it was chosen by the company. And we had one guy, fantastic guy from the US, from Snowflake. He was a BDR. And we all started like this.
That's great.
And after this, you extend. But we had this first piece of people.
That's it. And it's funny, I was about to say about the trust thing, and then you brought it up. But for me, you're definitely talking about building trust there. But there is no way someone, you know, makes one move to another company for 2 months, and then at where Snowflake were in 2016, where you were, nobody makes a move again just by looking at the tech and looking at the background. They make the move emotionally based on exactly what you said there, which is trust. And then there must have been something between you and that gentleman that, you know, he was ready to, you know, as you say, head and hands. He just knew and it was probably a little bit of a head versus heart argument going on inside of him. And his heart won because of trust. And I think we see that in recruiting. We also see it in our deals as well. And that's, you know, a big part of where the champion play comes in, which is going back, you know, a couple of steps where you said around the champion builders and looking for champion builders over sort of industry or product experts. And that is a fascinating topic, I think. Is that something you would, you know, you would do again? Is that your kind of
So definitely, and right now I'm advising a lot of companies, and I have this kind of discussion. Why? Because very easy. So when I changed from Bazaar Voice to Snowflake, I was looking to have a disruptive company and disruptive mm-hmm. solution. And I was honestly, I had in mind a move to cloud solution like mm-hmm. that now mm-hmm. Very quickly because I saw. I was in BMC when ServiceNow arrived and tried to compete with us and they killed the market. And now they are the solution de facto. And I was thinking, okay, so there will be other moves to cloud. And if you are part of that, because it's very difficult. So I have been approached by companies who are inventing something and inventing a solution. Mm-hmm. But very difficult to crack up the market when you arrive in Europe. So first you are unknown. And on top of that, you have a technology that is completely unknown where you need to build mm-hmm. the for the customer of where you need to build the market. Where here, the pain was here. The market was an old market. The only thing is we did that in a disruptive way. Mm-hmm. And I felt that immediately. Mm-hmm. I felt the potential of, okay, first we will have, yes, new use case, but we will have also a replacement market that is absolutely huge of legacy mm-hmm. solutions. And when I was looking at those legacy vendors, it's like Teradata and IBM and Oracle and also the other competitors on the cloud space. But no offense to that, but it's different people and different salespeople.
Yes.
Because most of the time, those guys, they were sitting on the interviews, they were sitting there for like 15 and 20 years. And the disruptive guys, the guys who are changing things in life are not people who are staying 25 years in a company, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. See, people that took risk at a period of time, and they are there to change things. And this is always what I was looking for, to have people that are here to change the world. And very quickly, when I built the team, I said, guys, we will be the solution de facto on the market at one point. Mm-hmm. And you need to have this state of mind. And you are there to really be on the market and being the company that Snowflake is today. And this is very important, but you need to have specific people for that.
Yeah, that state of mind thing is a fascinating one to me, because I think it plays so many parts of a sales organization's success is their state of mind. And I think something we talk about a lot, and something I think it runs back to, is that if I am of that mindset of my technology is the best, my technology is going to bring unbelievable value to you, Mr. and Mrs. Customer. And you just, that is as clear in your mind as it ever could be. Then the confidence that comes with that builds a certain profile, a certain attitude, a certain approach into the salesperson, which is very qualified. You know, you qualify very hard because you kind of have this mindset of, well, if you're, you know, I'm going to dig into whether we have an opportunity here. And if there's not, see you later. I'm on to the next one because everyone wants to talk to me right now. And I think that kind of, that builds that kind of FOMO that, and it becomes a real kind of catalyst for success that I see so often. And then once that flywheel starts spinning, it's very hard to slow it down then, because obviously that confidence breeds success and success breeds more success. And so I love to hear that you had that there. And then where you were mentioning disruptive, that is a really interesting word for me. And I think that really does sum up, that's probably the perfect word to sum up what you were discussing as your strategy there of the kind of people you wanting to put on the ground and as your first people. Is that something, did you use that word just as that came to mind, or is that something that you
have? No, you know what, when I, so I would be super honest on when I did the choice. Of going to Snowflake. And honestly, I was hesitating. Mm-hmm. I was hesitating because Snowflake was not known, but it was a sort of evidence. And if you ask Chris, and he knew that I was talking to other companies, mm-hmm. and at one point, he felt that probably, okay, we lose Thibaut for another one. But what makes the difference, it's him. It's him, it's Bob Moglia, it's Dennis Pearson, probably with the actual CMO, the best CMO I met in my life. And the inspiration of Bob Moglia, who was the CEO, I felt this disruption. And I was looking for that. And in other companies that I met, either they were not necessarily ready to go straight away, but I felt that we were on something that will change. And mm-hmm. Chris, because what is extremely good and it's extremely rare. So Chris is the actual CRO, but Chris did what I did. So he was the first man, almost the first man on the ground.
Yeah.
And we respect him for life for that. Because, and this is what I like also. So when you speak to managers, when you speak to Cédric Pech, to Jeremy Degan, to John, to Paul McGrath, to Alim Belkatir, to Mauro Trione, all those guys, they were good managers, excellent managers, sometimes brilliant leaders, but they were extremely good sales guys.
Yes.
And this is the case of Chris. So when I had this interaction, he was leaving Snowflake, literally. It was sweating Snowflake when he was talking about it. And this is why I jumped into it and I felt, okay, this is a disruption I'm looking for.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that disruption mindset carries forward from, you know, as you said, it's interesting talking about Chris sort of going through the same process. I'm sure him coming in as the first sales guy for Snowflake and then building the teams and then obviously building globally out and sort of you kind of repeating his journey in a regional sense is one thing. But then taking that disruptive mindset to customers, I think, is another thing. You mentioned a lot about how you know, Snowflake was unknown. You know, I can remember when Snowflake, I started hearing about Snowflake, it was because of the noise you were making from the success, and people start to talk, but you know, you got to have that success before people hear about it. So rewinding back, where, as you said, people thought you were an ice cream company. We had the same thing at Sprinklr once, where someone wanted some sprinklers, fire, you know, prevention sprinklers. And, you know, we had the conversation, I think it was Q4, whether, you know, well, could we, you know, find some and sell them and still book it as revenue towards our target? But unfortunately not. But yeah, and that going in as a new company, new proposition in a lot of ways, does need that disruptive mindset. It comes very close to sort of the challenger sales sort of mindset. And one of the things that I always think is an additional challenge that organizations have in that regard is, not only are you approaching companies who often don't have necessarily a budget reserved for the proposition that you have, but also because of that, they've never bought it before. They have no idea of what the criteria is and therefore the decision criteria is. And so you not only have to kind of go in with that as a challenge, but it becomes an additional thing that you have to take care of. And you know, I think that again is like where the divide of good and elite really becomes a bigger divide, where your salespeople can go and really help to craft and influence that decision criteria.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so on decision criteria is key. So so you mentioned John Kaplan, I think. So, but what was fantastic with Snowflake is because I met many startups in my life, but the foundations of what great is were there. Mm-hmm. So John arrived at Kaplan and with the training. But because of the impulse of Chris and myself in Europe, we were already doing a lot of things to make sure that we have the right basis and the right foundation. It was not like a revolution but John helped Kaplan with force management, helped to have a framework to make sure that everybody will say the same things and everybody will work on the decision criteria. Mm-hmm. That will help to win against the competition. And this is something, if you look at the market, we realize, because we were so prepared on unique differentiators, that we can argue. And we were the most difficult thing when you start is to qualify out an opportunity, because you are, so the first meetings you get, you are so happy, and the guy said, yeah, we can embrace you in the sales campaign. And but after that, if you look at the RFP and the way it's written, most of the time, the decision criteria, it's not coming from you. And, mm-hmm. and customers, I don't blame the customers, because they have so many companies that they need to meet. It's mm-hmm. impossible for them, mm-hmm. impossible for them to build proper decision criteria without mm-hmm. the help of a vendor. Mm-hmm. So if you're not there early enough to influence this, somebody else will do it.
Yes.
And in that case, sometimes you need to be ready to qualify out. And I think very quickly, when we started with Julien and Marcus and the rest, we qualify out some opportunities, and we were extremely tough on that. So, and because at the beginning, you will meet a lot of companies who will say, okay, we do POC, POV of the solution, let's go. And all companies are saying yes, but we were saying no. And we were saying no because we were so convinced that the technology was good, and we wanted to have the right criteria before doing a POC or a POV. And this was extremely important.
And tell me, in some of those instances where you kind of put the brakes on and said to the customer, no, we're going to qualify, you know, obviously you don't say we're going to qualify out, but you start that motion in process saying, look, it doesn't quite feel like, you know, there's the criteria is matching, or however you'd articulate it. Were there instances where the customer kind of turned around then and sort of said to you, well, actually, okay, well, tell us why you don't think it's a fit, and you were able to kind of re-engage off the back of kind of pushing back and then able to re-influence the criteria?
Yeah, but it's everything is linked to champions. So, so if you have some people who understand quite quickly your technology, so if when you start a business, the two important things, they are not necessarily the decision criteria. When you start a business, the first opportunities are impossible without a proper pain identifier, because this is where the money sits, mm-hmm. and a champion that can defend your solution. When we started, we were looking for champions because we were unknown and they don't buy into. So, for example, yesterday I did an analysis of the I helped to do an analysis of a startup, and all the names they were mentioning are just American names. Mm-hmm. And when you start here, so we had this obsession of adding new customers in Europe, because mm-hmm. if you have like Walt Disney and Netflix and Bank of America, it doesn't resonate enough here.
Yes.
It's good proofs, but mm-hmm. it's not necessary what you need here. So we had this maniac obsession, and at the beginning we were focusing on finding the problems they had and building some champions to make sure that they can influence this piece of decision criteria. And if you have a proper champion, you can ask him and say, you know what, I don't feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I learned this out of my 15 years working with Medic of 14 years of doing that and qualify out some opportunities. So it's very important.
Yeah, I have this saying of nobody ever regrets qualifying out.
Yeah.
And I'm still, you know, I like to say it a lot because I think it's true, but I also say it because I want to provoke someone to try and prove me wrong, because I'm genuinely curious if there's ever a time that anyone's ever regretted it. To date, no one ever has. So yeah, for me, it's a super interesting one. And so in the decision criteria for me is like such an interesting part of Medic. I think it's such a, you know, again, if we're looking at the difference between those elite salespeople and the rest, it's the elite salespeople that don't just take control of the decision criteria. But what I see happen is that they take control of the decision criteria, they influence it, but then they make it almost like the theme. If it's a sales campaign, if it's a sales process, if it's an RFP, whatever it is, if there's a lot of engagement, they almost kind of find their unique differentiators in that decision criteria. And they, you know, they title their proposal with that, you know, they put a play on words on it. And that's a thing that I think is something that I don't see that much of in the grand scheme of things of Medic. And I'd love to see more of it. Is there any, especially with Snowflake, obviously you had such success, but you were, as you said earlier, disrupting the market with a new view of a proposition. Were there any kind of great tactics, strategies that you folks were doing to kind of push the decision criteria?
Yeah, so everything is related to what I said, making people realize. So I remember also when we did the first sales campaign with Sainsbury's, and I met the CIO, and the guy said, nobody will get, so it was a replacement of Teradata, and the guy said, nobody will be fired because they choose IBM. Yeah. But someone can be if they choose Snowflake and if it doesn't work. And I said to him, yeah, but nobody would be promoted if they necessarily take IBM, but they can with Snowflake.
Yeah.
And it's very important to, and at this period of time, we were in this situation with, and Marcus was the sales guy, and where we push back and we explain to them, it's not for us, it's more for you. Mm-hmm. If you do the problem you will meet in many companies, they have habits with the technology and they will want to do an apple to apple comparison.
Yes.
And somebody that was absolutely fantastic and brilliant and helped us at the beginning was Steve Erskovitz. He was managing pre-sales worldwide. Mm-hmm. And we were lucky enough to have him in our team mm-hmm. for a period of time. And he helped us to do some. So he was the counterpart of Chris, started the activity, and he was absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he built this concept of, okay, it's not apple to apple, but apple to apple pie.
I love that.
It's absolutely mind blowing. So you need to realize that, and it's difficult because people have their habits, but you need to explain to them. You can't do the same comparison. And you need to sell the apple pie. And Steve was and yes, we had Medic and we were using that, but it's everything related to how you can build the proper decision criteria. And what he did was by himself of this concept was extremely extremely important.
And you will
face the problem is you have so many competitors on the market and people will they have their own habits I remember I met the stock exchange in France, and they were only thinking about what they had in terms of solution, and they said, we just want to see the comparison. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, when you are on disruptive technology, you will do things that they didn't even think of.
Yeah.
And they need to understand the value of that.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of work.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things that people often overlook about that process of influencing the decision criteria, you're not just angling the solution towards your own solution, your own strengths. Yeah. But what you're also doing as well is you're being the person to inspire the change. You know, we talk a lot about being thought leaders. And if you're the person that first goes in and says, look, I understand that you do things like this, and I can see why you do it like that. What we are seeing is we have a lot of success with organizations like you who have started doing it like this. And all of a sudden you can sort of see these light bulbs going off. And what they will do is, not only you're differentiating yourself and influencing towards your own strengths, but also anyone else that follows you into that meeting room then will be judged against a new criteria. And if they don't bring it up, they're already on the back foot. So even if they do it, if they don't bring it up, they're seen as not as much as a thought leader, even if they have the same version of whatever it is, or even a better version, they don't bring up. And that for me is something I think is often overlooked. It's that, and it's going back to what you were saying earlier on about trust. Trust comes from sort of someone buying into you. And it's very, you know, as you mentioned, very important for champion building. And so it's not just, you know, the decision criteria for me is not just about that sort of technical decision criteria and differentiation. It's about building that sort of inspiration in the customer and them seeing you as someone that brings value, not just from a product, but from how they're approaching the project.
Sure.
Yeah, super interesting. Okay, so one thing I want to dig into before we run out of time is, you know, starting a region as we've talked about and building it to the success that you had. How many interviews must you have done over the last 4 or 5 years?
I think around like 380.
380. And what's amazing about that is I imagine that, you know, organization like Snowflake, before you're doing the interviews, there's almost like a, you know, it's a pretty filtered process for people to get through to you. So I'm guessing those 380 people are very well qualified candidates before they get to you. Wow.
It's a good topic to discuss. Mm. So on the 380, it was not only sales. It was almost every. So I met at the beginning. So not so right now we have 750 people in Europe. So it's quite big. Mm. But when we started, I wanted to make sure that the people will fit within the culture and will be the right people for the team. So I met everyone. Mm-hmm. So when you start a startup like that, you can't do things yourself, and you can't have necessary at the beginning. After that, it's different. At the beginning, you can't hire without help of proper headhunters. What we did well is, I think, so we at the beginning we were using one headhunter, and after this we extend to three by region, and we give them exclusivity. Mm. So it means that the guy who was working for France was only working for France. And I gave always the analogy of, let's say, a real estate agency. When your house is in 10 different real estate agency, everyone is thinking,
what's wrong with it? It must be something wrong with it. They're desperate.
I can negotiate. I can do something. Yeah. Where you have one single one that has exclusivity, in that case, it's completely different. Mm-hmm. For that, you need to have a good product or you need to have a good house. But we had the good product and we had the good solution.
Yeah.
And so we work with exclusivity, and all those headhunters, so we had three companies, they were... also, we had the help of Chad Pitts. So Chad is working at Sutter Venture. It's probably the best headhunter I met in my life. And he's a friend and very strong guy. And we were doing literally bi-weekly call to see where we were. So we were onboarding 15 to 17 people a week at a point.
Wow.
So and it was a machine to hire. Mm-hmm. So right now, it's a natural growth. But I opened 14 different countries, and I was on each single one. I don't think now that I'm leaving Snowflake, I don't think they have new necessary countries. So 14 different countries where I did all the openings, being there meeting the people, being on site to meet the candidates. And we, if you are not organized, it doesn't work. Yeah. And Chad helped us to give this cadence with the headhunters, and he was managing this. He's working with Mike Spicer, who was a fantastic, absolutely fantastic guy. That was the first investor on Snowflake.
Oh, wow.
They work together. So we had this very good motion in place.
Interesting.
I will recommend, by the way, that I will recommend to have limited headhunters. Spend some time with them. If a headhunter doesn't ask questions regarding your business or a sales campaign, it's a red flag. But all those guys, they were asking, we were training them. I meet them a lot and they were able to talk about it. And in that case, it helped to attract all the right people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think so many people, when they thinking about recruiters, they think about the quality of candidates they bring through and make a judgment on there. But what you're not seeing is the amount of good candidates that are, I don't want to say being burnt, that's too much of a harsh statement, but the amount of candidates that are A players, absolutely the candidates you're looking for, but because the recruiter has not quite understood the proposition or the opportunity, yeah, and they don't have that credibility to capture that person's attention, you don't get to see them. And so, and likewise, you know, once that person's been tapped up once for the role, to your analogy around real estate, it's exactly the same thing. You know, you have this mindset of, well, they must be really desperate. I don't want to go anywhere that's desperate for salespeople. I want to go somewhere that's like, you know, on the up and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, fascinating insight for that. That's really interesting. And then when someone's in front of you, you know, I guess a really good way of for me to understand, when someone's in front of you, and you, has there ever been a situation, and maybe it happens a lot, where you've met someone and in the first 5 minutes, you feel that thing, you know, when you're interviewing somewhere, you're flipping, all of a sudden you've still got to qualify them, you've still got to interview them, but you're also you're turning on sales mode a bit yourself, because you're like, this is, I'm onto something here. Do you find that, and if so, what can you characterize what those things are that make you feel like that?
So obviously, with the more experience you have, you're able to understand what good people are, at least for your company. So there are two topics. The first topic is on the sales side, mm-hmm, and the second topic is on the culture side. Mm-hmm. So sales, if I talk about during an interview with the salespeople. So what was very important is, if you are good in your career, you don't need to prove yourself too much. So what I mean by that is I never needed to over talk about what I did, because the results I had or the choices I did speak by themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is something very important. So at the beginning, you know that. So if you, and yesterday, it's funny because I'm following, I'm not a big guy on the social network, at least Instagram, but I'm following one guy, and I think it speaks for everything. The guy is a gentleman modern. It's very nice. He likes everything that is nice in life, but he put a quote that is not for me, I think, but yeah, that resonates a lot. It's speak with honesty, think with sincerity, and act with integrity. Mm. And I think, honestly, this is a summary of what everything that I was looking for.
And
so I'm thankful, because I saw that yesterday night. So I was thinking about our discussion, and this guy is fantastic. So he's very, I recommend to follow him on Instagram. But this quote speak for everything, because when you speak to someone, you will see if he's honest when he speak, you will see if he's sincere, and you will see that immediately. So I'm able with experience now to see fake people. But when somebody is honest, you can feel that. When somebody is not overplaying regarding his results, you can feel that. When somebody is doing the right things in his life, personal life and professional life, you know that he has the right level of integrity, the way he treats his friends, the way he treats his wife, the way he treats his work. And very, very, very easily you can have this. And what I was thinking when I met Chris Degnan was, the conversation was very simple. And every time when you have a simple conversation between people, you will see that you are on the right path of finding someone. It's very important. As soon as it's becoming complex and you don't understand what the people are saying, it's difficult.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, it comes back to that feeling and that trust. And it's not so much of a conscious thing. You think, oh, this is getting complicated, I don't like where this is going. It's more of a feeling you have inside of yourself. Like, yeah, I can vibe with this person. I can see myself working with them and that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's super, super interesting. So Thibaut, this has been exceptional fun for me. As always with these shows, I feel like I come out and my brain is just three times the size it was before. So thank you so much, Mi. I already know this is going to be a hugely popular episode. There's going to be so many. It's going to be a struggle to pick out which sound bites we're going to pull from it. But thank you so much for your time. And if people want to connect with you, where should they find you? On LinkedIn?
They can. So LinkedIn, just don't send just an invitation. I think I have a backlog of like 600 invitations. So I'm not very good at that. So maybe it's more send a message through LinkedIn and the usual social network. Yeah. But thank you. Thank you. And congrats for your book. It's I think you told me, okay, I will send you this. You will not necessarily learn something. And I learned a lot.
Thank you.
But this is something very important that I always say to the team. So be prepared to have a learning state of mind, because you can always learn. And I learned a lot out of these books. So I really recommend people to read
it. Thank you very much, Thibaut. That's very kind of you to say. But thank you mostly for your time today. And I'm sure I speak for everyone that's listened through. Incredible stuff. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Andy.
Hey, so that wraps up episode number 6 of Masters of Medic. Thank you so much for listening. And if you liked what you heard, then please leave a rating and don't forget to subscribe.